What's on the docket for today is what I said. We're going to take up Kant's, we're going to look at what's wrong with the analytic synthetic distinction. I'm going to explain that. And after I do, we'll have a few comments about where Hume comes out in all of this, because that's what we were doing. We were winding up Hume, and then I'll get to Kant and his reaction to all of this. For Hume, this is the clinching argument. If all statements have to be analytic or synthetic, and he's correctly described each, then we can't get any legitimate law statement. We can't know that anything other than our own perceptions, so we don't know there's an external world. We also have lost the concept of a self. He said whenever he looked most intimately into himself, he only found some present impression or an idea, the copy of a past impression. He didn't find anything called the self. It's really like saying, I pointed the camera at this object and that, but none of them gave me a picture of the camera. In a way, it's a little silly. Okay, but now he's got the analytic synthetic distinction. These are the big guns. And it wasn't until past the middle of the 20th century that people began to catch on that this was a red herring. It was wrong, and it really didn't do any of the things he said. To show you why, I want to set this up again and want you to look at the board. Analytic statements are defined as statements in which the meaning of the subject, that is, the concept of the subject, includes whatever P asserts of it. That's the subject. So if the subject is bachelor and P is unmarried, then sooner or later in analyzing, that's why Kant used the term analytic, in analyzing the meaning of the subject, we come across the predicate unmarried. That's why we get an all statement. And this is supposed to explain where we get the idea of a necessary truth, of a law. So when we make a statement such as all water is H2O, that's because H2O is part of the meaning of water, and it can't be false. It's a law. Okay. Is that a good explanation for where we get the idea of a necessary truth? And the answer, I think, is no. For this reason, if the meaning of the predicate term of a sentence is not part of the meaning of the subject, it's not because the sentence isn't necessary, it's because the sentence isn't true. It's truth and falsity that are explained here, and Hume doesn't realize it. Any statement that asserts of a subject something that asserts this predicate, and this predicate is not part of the concept of the subject, it's because it's not true of the subject. Meaning containment is a condition for truth. Today is Thursday. That looks like a synthetic proposition. And it is. Okay, we bring together Thursday and today. But that's true if and only if today is Thursday. if it really has the property. That doesn't make it a necessary truth. It's not a necessary truth that today is Thursday. Today might be Tuesday or Friday, and I'm mixed up. So the definition of a synthetic statement, as Hume gives it, where the meaning of the predicate is not in the concept of the subject, is because the subject doesn't have that predicate, and the sentence is false. We're not looking at two kinds of statements, two kinds of true statements. It's not that analytic ones have the meaning containment and synthetics don't. No containment. I'll do it this way, no containment. If there's no containment of P and S, it's because P isn't one of the properties combined in the concept of S. And if it isn't, it's because it's not true of S. So take the example I gave you before, and it was, my house is brick. What defenders of this definition often try to do is give sentences like this as an example of a statement in which the meaning of the predicate is not contained in the meaning of the subject. That, ladies and gentlemen, is equivalent to the three-card trick. You know, where you put your money down and it disappears. Look at it again. They say the subject of the sentence is house, and house doesn't have to be brick. But the subject of the sentence isn't house, it's my house. And my house is brick. So if you had the proper concept of my house, one of the things you'd come across is that it's made of brick. And that's a condition for this being a true statement, not being a law. There is no law of nature that says that my house has to be brick. That's ridiculous. But it is in fact brick. And the sentence that asserts that it is brick, the meaning of the predicate is part of the meaning of the subject. That's what made it true. But it's still contingent. It's not necessary. So meaning containment doesn't distinguish necessary truths from contingent truths. It distinguishes true statements from false statements and leaves us unsatisfied and unanswered as to where we got the idea of a law. If the only thing that comes into our minds is first in the senses, then we can't have an idea of law, but we bloody well do. Read Galileo and Newton. We have laws proposed all over the place and experiments that confirm them. So this is a howler. This is a really bad mistake that will buffalo a lot of people for a long time. This is why there's no proof of God. There's no proof of God because if the statement's analytic, it's true only by definition. Depends how we define the subject and the predicate. If it's not just true by definition, if it really is a matter of fact, well, then it's only contingent. And you see, in the rationalist tradition, they tried to prove that God's existence was a necessary truth. That existence was part of the definition of God. Some of the most famous arguments for the existence of God argued that way. It may sound silly to you, but they did. Said God is defined as the being with all perfections and only perfections. Therefore, he has to have perfect existence. That convincing to you? I'm sorry, it's not to me. There, I think Hume is right. You can't just define something as existing and therefore it is. No, poof, for that easy, I could get $10 million by defining it as being in my bank account, and then it would have to be there. Because being in my bank account is one of the perfections. It's the chief perfection. Well, anyway, I think you see the problems with this. And Kant misses it. He does not say the analytic synthetic distinction is in fact a distinction between true and false statements. It doesn't tell us why the ones that appear to be necessarily true are, and the ones that appear to be not necessarily true really are not. It doesn't straighten all that out. That doesn't account for where we got the idea of a law in the first place. So look at Hume's record here before we go on to how Kant treats it. Hume wants to say we can't know there are external objects, an external world. And why? Because there's nothing in the mind not first in the senses. But then, how would we know this? It's not a set of percepts that come into the mind. There's nothing in the mind, not first in the senses. Oh, yes, there is. The idea that there's nothing in the mind, not first in the senses, doesn't come through the senses. It's one of the things you couldn't know if you were right, if it's right. How would it get in your mind? The same thing holds for his other points. We have no knowledge of anything called the self, the one who perceives, the one who thinks. Remember, whenever I look most intimately into myself, I never come across anything but some present perception and impression, or the copies of past impressions. And he tells us that a woman wrote him a letter and said, then what's the I that looks into myself? And he just says, I don't know. So something's looking into himself, but since he doesn't find that to be a perception, he dismisses it. Because otherwise, it would violate the rule that there's nothing in the mind, not first in the senses. On which ground he also rejects the external world. So since this is false, this is. And since this is false, this is. It's called modus tollens in logic. See, he's sweeping the board. He's cleaning house, man. There is no self. There are no external objects. There's no set of ethics you can know. You can't prove that God exists. Not the God of the Bible. You might prove that something or other designed to some kind of intelligence. Maybe. Is the best you can get out of that. But it's certainly, you can't show it's only one. It's also creator. It also offers you a covenant of love, forgiveness, and everlasting life. None of that comes along. So Kant is root of the world, himself, others, God, science. He's like the drunk that starts the fight in the bar and wrecks the bar. It's all wiped out. And that's the way Kant sees it. Kant said he was stirred from his dogmatic slumber. that he was just like somebody dreaming. And he accepted the self, the world, God, ethical right and wrong. And now comes a guy. A guy comes along and sweeps them all away and says, you can't know them. You can't know any of them. So Kant just can't let him get away with that. And he, in 1781, Kant published the Critique of Pure Reason. And he says something now that Locke had said, but that kind of got ignored then by Berkeley and Hume. The way to start out is to lay, is to analyze how the mind works. I mean, before we conclude what does or doesn't exist, we have to figure out what the mind can know and what it can't. And to do that, we have to introspect and find out as much as we can about how the mind operates. How it operates in ordinary experience, how it operates in perception, how it operates in abstraction and forming concepts, and so on. And Kant says, that's what I'm going to start with. And I'm going to explain to you, this is a very famous statement, how a priori synthetic judgments are possible. Remember the chart? It's supposed to be that synthetic statements are about matters of fact and they're not necessary. It's only analytic ones that are necessary and they're not about any facts. They don't have to be. But I'm going to show you how there are statements that are both synthetic, they're both about reality, and they're a priori, which means they're known from the meaning of the terms to be true. They're necessarily true, but they're about reality. And that's a law. That's what laws are. So every action has an equal but opposite reaction. It's supposed to be like synthetic judgments about the world, and like analytic judgments, necessarily true. The first thing I want to show you is how those statements are possible. You understand what he's saying? Is that he's going to show you how, besides analytic and synthetic, he's going to show you how a priori synthetic is another class of statements, and they exist too, and here's how and why, and I'll show you. Now I'm about to come to that, but you realize then what he's doing is accepting the analytic synthetic distinction, which I recommended that we not do, because it's false, that's why. And he's saying, but I can show you there's a third. So yes, Hume, you're right. There's analytic and synthetic, but I'm going to do an end run around that because I'm going to say there's also a third kind, and the third kind is the laws, and now I've saved science. Because there are two things that Kant will not let go. And one is science, and by that he means astronomy and physics and other emerging branches of science. In his own day, they were mostly under physics. They were things such as electrical theory and theory of vision, light transfer, and so on. But he expected more sciences to occur. Just after Kant, geology emerged, and there were a number of others. But anyway, they all require laws. And so he wants to save that. And the other thing that he thinks he must save (clears is ethics. He's going to show you that there are ethical laws, and that the ethical laws are necessary truths, just like the laws of science. See, there's a whole lot of things about which he doesn't think there are necessary truths. Anything that tries to prove the existence of God just falls flat. It can't be saved by his move here, he thinks. But it will save science, and it will save ethics, because it will show why there is necessary truth in science, necessary truths in ethics. The ethical statements that capture these laws, and he's going to show you how you know that they're necessary truths, and why they are therefore things that must never be done. So he lays out ethics in a system close to mathematics as he can get it. Now, don't lie was on his list. It's one of the first examples he gives in his theory of ethics. And he's going to say that turns out to be one of the necessary truths. It's always wrong to lie. I don't think so. I gave you an example already. The man who was hiding the Jewish families from the Nazis lied. And I think that was the right thing to do, because it was the loving thing to do. But Kant doesn't bring ethics down to love your neighbor as yourself, see. He brings it down to a formula for testing this statement to see whether it has certain logical properties. And if it has some, then it's right, and if it lacks them, it's wrong. So he equates ethical right and wrong with having certain logical properties to the statements. And I don't think that's what logic is about. But he did, that was his proposal, and he thinks he can get out from that, for example, it's wrong to lie, don't lie. The people who read it say, but you can't really mean that. You can't mean that you wouldn't lie to the Gestapo to save the innocent families? So Kant wrote a little tract, a little pamphlet, a more kind of popular work, and in it is this line. I would not lie, no, not to save mankind. And that has led some people to say that Kant wrote about ethics but was himself evil. Because if he wouldn't tell a lie that could save mankind, then he can just step off the stage and not talk to me at all. That's a little preview also. So how does Kant start out tackling this? If he misses that analytic is actually shows how a statement is true, and synthetic would make a statement false, if the meaning of what's asserted of something is a characteristic the subject doesn't really have, then the assertion that it has it is wrong. So he missed that. In fact, that might be a good way to start to introduce him. Let's see what else did he miss. I think we can do that. Kant misses the mistake in the analytic synthetic distinction. That's one big mistake. An even bigger one, which I guess I should have listed first, but I didn't say I would list them in the order of importance. Two is even more important. He misses the mistake that the given in experience, that is, what comes to us whether we will it or not. When I look over here, I see a clock on the wall. Not because I want to, but because there's a clock there. What is it that just comes to us, presents itself to us? That's been called the given in experience. It's just handed to us. We don't call it up. It doesn't result from anything we're doing. If I open my eyes and look in that direction, I see a clock. I can not look, or I can close my eyes. I don't have to see a clock. But if I look at that wall, I will. This given in experience is sensations. That's what comes into the mind. Sights, touches, smells, tastes, and sounds. They all miss that. I mean, that is just a given in modern philosophy. Descartes starts with that. He wants to believe there are external objects that have only physical properties, but they impact the mind, which is a rational thinking thing, by producing perceptions in the mind that are copies of the external objects. Right? You remember this? The trouble is, how can you have a purely sensory picture of a purely physical thing? The physical thing has no sensory properties in that theory. Right? A rock outside Descartes' window has no color, makes no sound, has no feel to it, doesn't smell in any particular way. Those are all things that register in minds. So they're not true of the rock. The rock only has physical properties. It only occupies space and moves, has weight and mass and density and so on. But if it has no sensory properties, a sensory picture can't copy it. All it has is physical properties, and they're not in minds. Minds are completely non-physical. So Descartes divides reality in two, and when he gets all done, he can't put Humpty back together again. But that didn't lead any of the people that followed him to say, "Well, wait a minute. The given in experience isn't perceptions. It isn't sights, tastes, touches, smells, and sounds. It isn't things that have only color, tactile sensations, smells, tastes. True of them. What's given to our experience are things like walls, lights, clocks, books over my shoulder, bookcases outside, cars in the parking lot. That's what's given. What comes to us, whether we want to or not, if we look in a certain direction, are the things and events and states of affairs and people and relationships that constitute the world around us. And we abstract from them, we single out logical properties from the rest, sensory properties from the rest, physical properties from the rest. And we may focus on a particular kind of properties, but in science we never deal exclusively with what we've picked on to focus. Because there is nothing that's purely physical, or purely sensory, or purely rational. There isn't anything that's purely anything. Nobody ever stopped to think of that. Dewey did in the 20th century. But these guys are convinced of what we'll call the empiricist dogma. The empiricist dogma is that what's given to us are colors, sounds, tactile feels, tastes, smells. That's it. In fact, the theory is they come in separated into the mind that combines them into objects. If that's right, there isn't anything that we experience that's really given. They're all artifacts that our minds put together. And so if you're willing to buy that, I guess it's no big deal to say, and we don't know that these reflect an outside world at all. Maybe there is nothing called the external world. Or if there is, anyway, we don't know anything about it. So why would it have to be like the copy, like what occurs in our minds? Right? There are causes that produce effects that are nothing like the causes. If I take 5 pounds of plutonium and 5 pounds of plutonium, and in the right circumstances, I smack them together and set off dynamite, I get one hell of a mushroom cloud. Okay, but that, nothing like a lump of metal, a lump of metal, and the explosion of a dynamite stick. One's not the copy of the other. So we don't think that copies, that causes always have to produce effects that copy them. That's not true. We want to say that some of them do, like our normal sense perception, but I don't think normal sense perception gives us copies. Now, what other mistake? Okay, we're going to say, here's the argument given by Berkeley and repeated by Hume as to why our perceptions are not the same as the external world. And that's, I'll call it counter examples to realistic perception. We did this before, but it doesn't matter if it's a mistake. I mean, we're covering it because it's one that Kant makes too. He assumes this from his predecessors. Counterexamples to realistic perception. And what are they? Well, they're things like putting a stick in water and having it appear bent. The bent part of the stick is an optical illusion. We say the real stick is still straight. But in that case, the appearance of the bent stick has to be something different from the stick itself, because the stick itself doesn't bend when we put it in the water. There are other things like this. The railroad tracks, we're walking along the railroad tracks, and as we look ahead up toward the horizon, the railroad tracks appear to converge. But we know that they don't converge. We can walk right down to the spot that looked like convergence, and they're still the same width, and they still have the steel rails and the wood bases that they're attached to. And they're just as wide apart as ever. So there have to be two things. There has to be the real track that doesn't converge and our picture of it that does. You get what that's the argument. There has to be another thing inside our minds that does converge and it isn't really representing the truth about the object. There are lots of other examples like the same thing. Like all things appearing to get smaller the further away they are. Now, infants make out the truth of this, and are not fooled by these things. And I'm saying that the theory that there are two things involved, that one is supposed to be the copy of the other, but manages in some serious way not to be, is not the best explanation or the simplest. The simplest explanation says that when I have, or let's take, I paint a wall white, and then later after it dries, I shine a certain shade of purple onto the wall and the wall appears lavender. Is that because there are two different things? The wall, which is really white, and what appears lavender in my mind? Or is this a better explanation? The white surface of the wall has the disposition to appear white to normal vision in normal light, but purple in the presence of this kind of light. In that case, why can't we say the same thing about the converging railroad tracks. The railroad tracks have, among other properties true of it, the properties of appearing to converge at the horizon or at some distance to normal vision in normal light. Just so, the example with the stick. The stick not only is straight, but has the disposition to appear bent in water. Now, all those dispositions that I just talked about, the tendency, the potential property, are sensory properties. It has the sensory dispositional property to appear bent in water, or the tracks to appear converged at the horizon, or for the wall to appear purple under a black light. And the reason we speak of white as being the real color of the wall is because that's what normal perception sees in normal light. That black light here that I took out, plugged in, shine on the wall, that's not normal light. These are normal perception. The tracks and the stick. But they are not being perceived under optimal conditions. Optimal condition for the stick is for it to be out of the water. Put it in water and we don't have optimal conditions anymore, and the disposition to appear bent is activated. Same thing for the tracks. Standing that low to the ground and looking down the tracks is not optimal perception. Being up in a helicopter and seeing the tracks spread across the land below me, they don't appear to converge. That's the optimal position for observing them. So the optimal conditions for that are not to be standing my height on the ground or yours and look down the railroad track. Why isn't that a more obvious and simpler explanation of what's going on? The fact is then these things all have sensory properties. They're passive to our perceptive abilities, and they're only potential till they're activated. But we don't have to say there are two things. We don't have to multiply entities needlessly. That rings a bell with you. It's called Occam's Law. It says the better theory always guesses at fewer things. If we can explain something with three guesses, three theories, and everything else takes more, then we prefer every other theory takes more, has four and five and six and ten, then the one with three is the one we take, if they have the same explanatory power. And I'm saying that what I'm suggesting to you has the same explanatory power and doesn't need to postulate a second set of realities inside our heads and then be startled at the conclusion, duh, that's all we really know, so we don't know the word, there's a world. Do you realize that? This is pretty extreme, right? These are things that Kant missed. The Enlightenment is often praised as a period in which people threw off superstition and followed reason and developed science and all the rest of the stuff. We're really coming out of the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages. Yeah? And what do you end up with? Well, we're not sure there's a world. What? For many years, I told my students, if you think that's nuts, you're right. If there's anything you know, is that you're not the only thing in the universe. You're in a world, and there's a world contains things, events, states of affairs, relations, other people. Of course there is. Because normal sense perception shows you those things to be self-evidently there, to be real. Now the Enlightenment gives itself that name. Kant's the guy that wrote an essay called What is Enlightenment? And he says, dare to think, dare to postulate what things are really like. Be bold, strike out. Sounds like the rationalists, right? They thought that was the way to go. And they ended up inventing the weirdest stuff. Like, well, reality is really monads. And monads have physical power and they're all conscious. So the dust under your feet knows you're stepping on you. On what? This is serious? Yeah. And they said that they were a period of enlightenment as compared with what? The Middle Ages. Well, the Middle Ages were dominated by philosophers who were Christians or Jews or Muslims. And they all took normal sense perception to be reliable. That's one thing that you can know. You can know things that are self-evident, evident to the senses, or proven. They all held that. And these guys, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, and now Kant, are going to say, no, we don't. We can't trust normal sense perception because it has these dispositions to appear other than the way things really are, provided it's not optimal conditions for observing them, or our observation equipment's not functioning right. So they think they're enlightened because the Middle Ages were dumb enough to think that ordinary sense perception, normal sense perception, reveals the world as it is. Huh. That's not progress, it's regress. So let's look at what the Enlightenment bequeaths to us. There's a real world independent of us. We can't know that. Our self is active in gaining knowledge of the world. But this means the real world. And the answer is no, and we don't know much about the self. So I'm trying to be fair with this. No, we don't know there is a self, or if there is, we don't know much about it. Now, it's hard to think of anything sillier than saying there are no human selves, there are no minds, there's no such thing as consciousness. This is what Hume came to. There are just the perceptions. Oh yeah, what are they? How can something be a perception unless somebody perceives it? There has to be a perceiver, right? And Hume says, no, whenever I look into myself, I don't find something called a self. I find some present impression or past. Why the heck would you expect to find yourself being one of the perceptions yourself has? That's like saying every time a camera takes a picture, it itself should show up in the picture. I mean, these are their assumption that minds operate like cameras. I'm not saying they do. I'm saying given their own assumptions, these are silly conclusions to draw. This is self. And they're certainly, it's not true they can be certain about God. Now, to be fair about the idea of God. I want to say that Descartes tried to prove that God existed. So did Locke, so did Berkeley, so did Spinoza, and so did Leibniz. It's Hume and Kant that don't. But they don't leave that matter entirely in the dark. According to Hume, and I could read this passage to you, but it's impressive. Hume says that the arguments fail. But that should drive a person to consult revelation. And by revelation, he means the scriptures. And that's a very remarkable statement from somebody you wouldn't expect it from. You'd never think Hume would say a thing like that. Look, you go back and forth and back and forth. You agonize. You look at all the arguments. They're all inconclusive. Maybe it's trying to show you that if you're wise, you go back to Revelation, which is the real source of the knowledge of God, not our own reasoning. Now, I could applaud that one. I think he's right. That's Hume. Unfortunately, it is not Kant. God is an idea that cannot be proven. But is useful in life. And that's where Kant's going to leave it. The idea of God has heuristic value. That means we live as though there were a God, but we don't know there is. That's what he's recommending. In the first place, I don't think it's possible to do that, and I don't think it's desirable to do that. You know God or you don't. And if you haven't met God in your own experience, especially through Scripture and His Word, reading His Word, there's no other way you're going to know God and know that God is real. It only comes about that way, the way Hume recommended. At the end. So, next time we will launch into Kant proper, and we will see what he does with the analytic synthetic distinction, how he tries to show that there's a third kind of statement, synthetic a priori. And then he wants to go from there. If there are law statements about reality, and that means the sensations in our heads, remember, that are necessary truths, then we can get science. I'm going to close with a sort of amusing story. It really happened. When I taught at Rutgers, there was a history professor who had an office not too far from mine, and he told me this. He said, all through my undergraduate years, and then again in graduate school, I found that when I met the people who were working in philosophy, they were all these super bright types of guys, and I really was impressed, and I wondered why it was so. So I wondered, is there anything, there must be something to philosophy. I'll find out. So he made an experiment, and his experiment for himself was to go to the library, pick out a major work in philosophy, and read it cover to cover and see if there's anything in it that is interesting and important. And what did he pick? He picked Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. One of the most difficult things to read that has ever been penned on this planet. And he didn't know what Hume had already done or said. And he comes across a sentence like this. I am writing this book, God says, to show how a priori synthetic judgments are possible. And this poor guy goes, what? And he tries another sentence and another sentence. And it's all gibberish. So he said to me, so I put the book back and I never thought about it again. There's nothing to philosophy, it's all phony. Everybody's just arguing about nothing. And I'm doubled over in laughter. Because anybody, I'm not laughing at him, but it's funny that he's got to pick one of the most difficult things anybody ever wrote, who starts right in at his period in history, assumes that you know what Locke and Hume and everybody else have been saying, and that he's going to show where the right, where the wrong, and why. But he has his own jargon. That's another truth about Kant. He makes up his own vocabulary as he goes along, and he almost never defines his terms. And it's up to you to figure out what the heck this term means by the way he uses it. And then, even then, sometimes he's not consistent in using it that way, and that puzzles you. And whenever he gives an example of something, it's undoubtedly not an example of what he's been talking about. His attempt to give examples is terrible. All difficulties with reading Kant. I think it would be useful in this course for you students to read something about Kant in conjunction with my lectures. But I'm not recommending that you read Kant himself, because I don't want you to put my picture on your dartboard and throw darts at it. But we'll see you next time, and I'll explain how Kant carries all this on.